The wand of yew is reputed to endow its possessor with the power of life and death, which might, of course, be said of all wands. And yet yew retains a particularly dark and fearsome reputation in the spheres of dueling and all curses. However, it is untrue to say, as those unlearned in wand lore often do, that those who use yew wands are more likely to be attracted to the dark arts than another. The witch or wizard best suited to a yew wand might equally prove a fierce protector of others. Wands hewn from these most long-lived trees have been found in the possession of heroes quite as often as of villains. Where wizards have been buried with wands of yew, the wand generally sprouts into a tree guarding the dead owner's grave. What is certain, in my experience, is that the yew wand never chooses either a mediocre or a timid owner.
Wand lengths and flexibility. In this, his last recorded treatise on wand types, Mr. Ollivander notes that he rarely sells wands over 15 inches. However, he speaks of a physical peculiarity that leads one particular individual to require a larger wand than usual. Perhaps Ollivander is referring here to everyone's favorite half-giant, Hagrid. As Ollivander recalls in Philosopher's Stone, Hagrid's wand is oak, 16 inches, rather bendy. So it certainly meets the description.
The following notes on wand length and flexibility are taken from notes on the subject by Mr. Garrick Ollivander, wand maker.
Many wand makers simply match the wand length to the size of the witch or wizard who will use it. But this is a crude measure and fails to take into account many other important considerations. In my experience, longer wands might suit taller wizards, but they tend to be drawn to bigger personalities and those of a more spacious and dramatic style of magic. Neater wands favor more elegant and refined spell casting. However, no single aspect of wand composition should be considered in isolation of all the others, and the type of wood, the core, and the flexibility may either counterbalance or enhance the attributes of the wand's length. Most wands will be in the range of between 9 and 14 inches. While I have sold extremely short wands, 8 inches and under, and very long ones, over 15 inches, these are exceptionally rare. In the latter case, a physical peculiarity demanded the excessive wand length. However, abnormally short ones usually select those in whose character something is lacking, rather than because they are physically undersized. Many small witches and wizards are chosen by longer ones. Wand flexibility or rigidity denotes the degree of adaptability and willingness to change possessed by the wand and owner pair, although, again, this factor ought not to be considered separately from the wand wood, core, and length, nor of the owner's life experience and style of magic, all of which will combine to make the wand in question unique.
When it comes to wands, there is no doubt Mr. Ollivander knows his stuff. But as he tells Harry, wand lore is a complex and mysterious branch of magic. So let's leave him there, in his gloomy shop, to continue studying the deep mystical connections that so clearly enthrall him. Shut the door, shake off any dust that has settled, and let's head back out to explore more of the everyday, but no less fascinating, magic of the wizarding world. Chapter 4. How the Wizarding World Works. As with most things in life, the practice of magic in the wizarding world is shaped by certain rules. Generally, these are less opaque than Mr. Ollivander's subtle laws of wand ownership, but that doesn't mean they are always followed. After all, as Hogwarts put-upon caretaker Mr. Filch would no doubt attest, the wizarding world has always had its fair share of rule breakers. The guiding principle behind most rules of magical engagement is the International Statute of Secrecy. Essentially, this means not doing magic in front of muggles. This is why when Ron and Harry are seen flying the enchanted Ford Anglia, it hits the front page of the Evening Prophet and leaves Mr. Weasley facing an inquiry. In some cases, the Ministry uses magic to regulate statute-related laws and controls. One example is the Trace Charm, which detects any underage magic performed outside Hogwarts. But the Ministry can't enforce everything. This is clearly evidenced by the fact that James Potter, Sirius Black, and Peter Pettigrew were able to transform into animals and run around Hogwarts without registering as animagi, as they should have done. Yes, Mr. Filch, the wizarding world has always had rule breakers. But not every rule needs to be enshrined in law. Because magic has its own limitations. You can't create food out of thin air, for example. As Ron discovers in Deathly Hallows, it's one of the five exceptions to Gamp's law of elemental transfiguration. You also can't use magic to bring someone back to life, and you can't make someone fall in love with you. Love potions exist, it's true. But even Amortentia can only cause what Professor Slughorn describes as infatuation or obsession. Finally, there are rules that are neither defined in law nor limited by magic. These are the codes of conduct, of a sort, Harry must learn when he enters the wizarding world, such as what to wear on formal occasions and not to say Voldemort's name out loud. It's a lot to learn. So, like Arthur Weasley taking apart that old Ford Anglia, let's get into the nuts and bolts. Extension charms. Arthur Weasley may enjoy tinkering with Muggle artifacts, but he is still a wizard. And so that rusty Ford Anglia ends up with some magical modifications. The ability to fly is one. Extra luggage space created by the application of an undetectable extension charm is another. Hermione later uses this same charm to enlarge her tiny beaded evening bag. And without that must-have Horcrux hunting accessory, Ron would have a lot more to moan about than lack of food. An extension charm is clearly a handy little spell. But does it have its limits?
Hogwarts school trunks, like the majority of wizarding luggage, are issued with capacity-enhancing or extension charms as standard. These spells not only increase the interior dimension of objects while leaving the outer ones unchanged, they also render the contents lighter. The extension charm, Capacious Extremis, is advanced, but subject to strict control because of its potential misuse. Theoretically, 100 wizards could take up residence in a toilet cubicle if they were sufficiently adept at these spells. The potential for infractions of the International Statute of Secrecy are obvious. The Ministry of Magic has therefore laid down a strict rule that capacity enhancement is not for private use, but only for the production of objects, such as school trunks and family tents, which have been individually approved for manufacture by the relevant ministry department. Both Mr. Weasley and Hermione Granger were acting unlawfully when they enhanced, respectively, the interior space of a Ford Anglia and a small handbag. The former is now believed to be living wild in the Forbidden Forest at Hogwarts, and as the latter played no insignificant part in the defeat of the greatest dark wizard of all time, no charges have been brought.
Technology. In general, technology is one area where the wizarding world lags behind the Muggle community. Most of the things Muggles rely on technology for can be managed with magic, however, so it does not concern anyone very much. Yes, Arthur Weasley is fascinated by Muggle machinery, and not just car engines, the man also collects plugs and batteries, but his enthusiasm is not typical. Even if Muggle technology were to suddenly become widely popular, many devices wouldn't function in areas of high magical concentration. As Hermione explains to Ron and Harry, Muggle substitutes for magic, such as electricity and computers and radar, don't work at Hogwarts because there is too much magic in the air. It sends most Muggle tech haywire. But this is not to say Muggle machinery has no place at all. As we'll see, some technologies have found favour outside Hogwarts. From the Weasleys' favourite radio broadcasts to Sirius's motorbike. What's so special about those particular technological advancements, then?
When you can summon any book, instrument or animal with a wave of the wand and the word axio, when you can communicate with friends and acquaintances by means of owl, fire, patronus, howler, enchanted objects such as coins, or apparate to visit them in person, when your newspaper has moving pictures and everyday objects sometimes talk to you, then the internet does not seem a particularly exciting place. This is not to say that you will never find a witch or wizard surfing the net, merely that they will generally be doing so out of slightly condescending curiosity, or else doing research in the field of Muggle studies. While they have no need of mundane domestic objects such as dishwashers or vacuum cleaners, some members of the magical community are amused by Muggle television, and a few firebrand wizards even went so far in the early 80s as to start a British Wizarding Broadcasting Corporation, in the hope that they would be able to have their own television channel. The project foundered at an early stage as the Ministry of Magic refused to countenance the broadcasting of wizarding material on a Muggle device, which would, it was felt, almost guarantee serious breaches of the International Statute of Secrecy. Some felt, and with justification, that this decision was inconsistent and unfair, as many radios have been legally modified by the wizarding community for their own use, which broadcast regular wizarding programs. The ministry conceded that Muggles frequently catch snippets of advice on, for instance, how to prune a venomous tentacula, or how best to remove gnomes from a cabbage bed, but argued that the radio-listening Muggle population seems altogether more tolerant, gullible, or less convinced of their own good sense than Muggle TV viewers. Reasons for this anomaly are examined at length in Professor Mordecai Egg's The Philosophy of the Mundane, Why the Muggles Prefer Not to Know. Professor Egg argues cogently that Muggles are much more likely to believe they have misheard something than that they are hallucinating. There is another reason for most wizards' avoidance of Muggle devices, and that is cultural. The magical community prides itself on the fact that it does not need the many, admittedly ingenious devices that Muggles have created to enable them to do what can be so easily done by magic. To fill one's house with tumble dryers and telephones would be seen as an admission of magical inadequacy. There is one major exception to the general magical aversion to Muggle technology, and that is the car, and to a lesser extent, motorbikes and trains. Prior to the introduction of the International Statute of Secrecy, wizards and Muggles used the same kind of everyday transport, horse-drawn carts and sailing ships among them. The magical community was forced to abandon horse-drawn vehicles when they became glaringly outmoded. It is pointless to deny that wizard kind looked with great envy upon the speedy and comfortable automobiles that began filling the roads in the 20th century. And eventually, even the Ministry of Magic bought a fleet of cars, modifying them with various useful charms and enjoying them very much indeed. Many wizards love cars with a childlike passion, and there have been cases of purebloods who claim never to touch a Muggle artifact and yet are discovered to have a flying Rolls-Royce in their garage. However, the most extreme anti-Muggles eschew all motorized transport. Sirius Black's love of motorbikes incensed his hardline parents.
Secret Keeper. Cars aside, Muggle technology really is no match for magic. Forget password protection and multi-factor authentication. If a witch or wizard wants to keep some valuable information secure, they have the Fidelius Charm. The Fidelius Charm is, as Professor Flitwick explains, an immensely complex spell. It places a significant amount of importance on the Secret Keeper, a person sworn to secrecy and bound by magic to keep safe information only they can divulge. This makes the Secret Keeper vulnerable and all-powerful at the same time. As you may recall, being entrusted with information only he could reveal gave James and Lily Potter's secret keeper, Peter Pettigrew, the perfect opportunity to betray them. He seemingly had no qualms about breaking the bonds of his Fidelius charm to tell Voldemort the Potter's location. But how? And why? Moral questions aside, what happens when a Fidelius charm is broken?
The Fidelius charm is extremely ancient and still used to this day. It involves the concealment of information inside a living person. The chosen person, or secret keeper, is the only person who is thenceforth capable of revealing the protected information to others, however many previously knew it. If the secret keeper shares the hidden information, the person to whom he or she has confided will be bound by the Fidelius charm and find it impossible to pass the information on. The Fidelius charm is not without its weaknesses. If the secret keeper wishes to do so, they may divulge the information at any time, although the secret cannot be forced, bewitched, or tortured out of a secret keeper who does not wish to give up their secret. It must be given voluntarily. If the secret keeper dies, anyone to whom he or she has confided the information will become a secret keeper. This could involve many people, any of whom might be more willing to share the secret. Generally speaking, being a secret keeper is a dangerous position to occupy. It is such a serious and binding enchantment that few would undertake it lightly. In spite of the fact that the secret can only be given up voluntarily, many have been subjected to the Imperius and Cruciatus curses in an effort to make them share their information.
Order of Merlin. Peter Pettigrew might be one of the Wizarding World's worst secret keepers, but somehow his epic double-dealing after betraying the Potters led to him being erroneously, and apparently posthumously, awarded an Order of Merlin First Class. As Ron tells Harry, Pettigrew's mother received the medal after her son's assumed death, along with his finger in a box. It might have given her some comfort at the time, but probably doesn't make up for the fact that Pettigrew is later revealed to have sold out his friends to Voldemort, faked his own death, and lived as a rat for 12 years. And Pettigrew's is not the only dubiously acquired Order of Merlin. Gilderoy Lockhart also received an Order of Merlin, although his was third class. So what are the criteria?
The Order of Merlin, sometimes abbreviated to OM, is awarded by the Wizengamot, an organisation that predates the Ministry of Magic and nowadays functions as a combination of court and parliament. The order comprises a handsome golden medal on a green ribbon, first class, purple ribbon, second class, or white ribbon, third class. The Order of Merlin, commemorating the most famous wizard of his time, has been given since the 15th century. Legend says that the green ribbon, on which the first class order hangs, is to reflect Merlin's Hogwarts house. The first class order is awarded for acts of outstanding bravery or distinction in magic. The second class is awarded for achievement or endeavour beyond the ordinary. And the third class is given to those who have made a contribution to our store of knowledge or entertainment. As often happens with such highly coveted awards, Ministry of Magic favourites seem to receive the Order of Merlin, especially the higher classes, more often than one might expect. While nobody argued when Albus Dumbledore received his OM, first class, for defeating the dark wizard Grindelwald, there was a good deal of muttering in the wizarding community when Cornelius Fudge, Minister for Magic, awarded himself an OM, first class, for a career that many considered less than distinguished. Other less worthy recipients of the highest class of order include Arcturus Black, Sirius Black's grandfather, who was widely believed to have bought it by loaning the ministry a large amount of gold.
Clothing. The Ministry of Magic may not be above a spot of alleged corruption, but in certain areas, their position has always been clear, and one of these is clothing. As outlined by the International Statute of Secrecy, witches and wizards are required to wear appropriate clothing in front of muggles. There are no exceptions, but there have been many infractions. Sometimes these come from ignorance. Archie, the wizard who wears a long flowery nightgown to the Quidditch World Cup, insists it is from a Muggle shop, and therefore counts as appropriate attire. Sometimes these come from a lack of awareness of Muggle trends. Even in the wizarding world, fashion can be fickle, Ron's lace-cuffed dress robes being a case in point. And sometimes a witch or wizard's decision to adapt their dress has a deeper meaning, intended to reveal an individual's connections or beliefs. So there are as many reasons for witches and wizards' fashion choices as there are Weasley jumpers. Time for a rummage in the wardrobe.
Wizards at large in the Muggle community may reveal themselves to each other by wearing the colours of purple and green, often in combination. However, this is no more than an unwritten code, and there is no obligation to conform to it. Plenty of members of the magical community prefer to wear their favourite colours when out and about in the Muggle world, or adopt black as a practical colour, especially when travelling by night. The International Statute of Secrecy laid down clear guidelines on dress for witches and wizards when they are out in public. When mingling with Muggles, wizards and witches will adopt an entirely Muggle standard of dress, which will conform as closely as possible to the fashion of the day. Clothing must be appropriate to the climate, the geographical region, and the occasion. Nothing self-altering or adjusting is to be worn in front of Muggles. In spite of these clear instructions, clothing misdemeanours have been one of the most common infractions of the International Statute of Secrecy since its inception. Younger generations have always tended to be better informed about Muggle culture in general. As children, they mingle freely with their Muggle counterparts. Later, when they enter magical careers, it becomes more difficult to keep in touch with normal Muggle dress. Older witches and wizards are often hopelessly out of touch with how quickly fashions in the Muggle world change. Having purchased a pair of psychedelic loon pants in their youth, they are indignant to be hauled up in front of the wizengamot 50 years later for arousing widespread offence at a Muggle funeral. The Ministry of Magic is not always so strict. A one-day amnesty was announced on the day that news broke of Lord Voldemort's disappearance following Harry Potter's survival of the Killing Curse. Such was the excitement that witches and wizards took to the streets in their traditional clothes, which they had either forgotten or adopted as a mark of celebration. Some members of the magical community go out of their way to break the clothing clause in the Statute of Secrecy. A fringe movement, calling itself Fresh Air Refreshes Totally, F-A-R-T.
Footnote. President Archie Ainslow.
Insists that Muggle trousers stem the magical flow at source and insist on wearing robes in public, in spite of repeated warnings and fines.
Footnote. To date, they appear to have been taken as cult members by Muggles.
More unusually, wizards deliberately adopt laughable Muggle confections, such as a crinoline worn with a sombrero and football boots.
Footnote. These are generally taken by Muggles to be students on a dare.
By and large, wizard clothing has remained outside of fashion, although small alterations have been made to such garments as dress robes. Standard wizard clothing comprises plain robes, worn with or without the traditional pointed hat, and will always be worn on such formal occasions as christenings, weddings, and funerals. Women's dresses tend to be long. Wizard clothing might be said to be frozen in time, harking back to the 17th century when they went into hiding. Their nostalgic adherence to this old-fashioned form of dress may be seen as a clinging to old ways and old times, a matter of cultural pride. Day to day, however, even those who detest Muggles wear a version of Muggle clothing, which is undeniably practical compared with robes. Anti-Muggles will often attempt to demonstrate their superiority by adopting a deliberately flamboyant, out-of-date, or dandyish style in public.
colours. At Hogwarts, every student wears a variation of the standard issue black robes, hat and cloak combo. But while their clothes might be uniformly magical, the hues of a student's house really define where they belong. In this context, Gryffindor red, Slytherin green, Hufflepuff yellow and Ravenclaw blue are more than just a shade of common room curtain. As soon as a student is sorted, the colours of their house become a kind of shorthand. Gryffindors are brave, Slytherins are cunning, Hufflepuffs are loyal, and Ravenclaws are wise. Whether or not every student lives up to their house's colourful reputation is another story, but the Hogwarts houses and their colours are undeniably infused with symbolism. And it isn't just at Hogwarts where colour is used to create deeper meaning.
Author's note. Witches and wizards often reveal themselves to each other in public by wearing purple or green, often in combination. In Britain and much of Europe, purple has an association with both royalty and religion. Purple dyes, being costly, were once worn only by those who could afford them. Bishops' rings are traditionally set with amethysts. Green has long had a supernatural connection in the UK. Superstition says that it ought to be worn with care. The fairies are supposedly possessive of it, as it is their proper colour. It ought never to be worn at weddings, due to a further association with misfortune and death. Green is the colour of much dark magic, of the dark mark, of the luminescent potion in which Voldemort conceals one of his Horcruxes, of many dark spells and curses, and of Slytherin House. The combination of purple and green, therefore, is suggestive of both sides of magic, the noble and the ignoble, the helpful and the destructive. The four Hogwarts houses have a loose association with the four elements, and their colours were chosen accordingly. Gryffindor, red and gold, is connected to fire. Slytherin, green and silver, to water. Hufflepuff, yellow and black, representing wheat and soil, to earth. And Ravenclaw, blue and bronze, sky and eagle feathers, to air. Colours like peach and salmon pink are distinctly unmagical, and therefore much favoured by the likes of Aunt Petunia. On the other hand, shocking pink, as sported by the likes of Nymphadora Tonks, conveys a certain punky, yes, I've got a muggle-born father and I'm not ashamed of it, attitude. Colours also played their part in the naming of Hagrid and Dumbledore, whose first names are Rubius Red and Albus White, respectively. The choice was a nod to alchemy, which is so important in the first Harry Potter book, where the red and the white are essential mystical components of the process. The symbolism of the colours in this context has mystic meaning, representing different stages of the alchemic process, which many people associate with a spiritual transformation. Where my two characters were concerned, I named them for the alchemical colours to convey their opposing but complementary natures. Red meaning passion or emotion, white for asceticism. Hagrid being the earthy, warm and physical man, lord of the forest. Dumbledore, the spiritual theoretician, brilliant, idealised and somewhat detached. Each is a necessary counterpoint to the other as Harry seeks father figures in his new world.
The Quill of Acceptance and the Book of Admittance. For witches and wizards raised by Muggles, their journey to Hogwarts typically starts with the arrival of their admittance letter. Those born into wizarding families will likely know about Hogwarts much earlier. Perhaps they've already developed a hierarchy of house choices, like Ron. Perhaps they're expecting to follow in a parent or sibling's footsteps, like Draco. Or perhaps they're hoping against hope they might buck the familial trend, like Sirius. Whatever a first year's hopes, even those who have grown up knowing about Hogwarts may not realise just how much Hogwarts already knows about them, in some cases, almost from birth. So, if you've ever wondered how a student registers for Hogwarts, why squibs are never offered a place, and how on earth Muggleborns get admitted, well, suffice it to say, Hogwarts does not have an ordinary school admissions process.
In a small locked tower, Never visited by any student at Hogwarts, sits an ancient book that has not been touched by human hands since the four founders placed it there on completion of the castle. Beside the book, which is bound in peeling black dragon hide, stands a small silver inkpot, and from this protrudes a long, faded quill. These are the quill of acceptance and the book of admittance, and they constitute the only process by which students are selected for Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. If anybody understands what powerful and long-lasting magic causes this book and quill to behave as they do, nobody has ever confessed to it. Doubtless because, as Albus Dumbledore once sighed, it saves the staff tedious explanations to parents who are furious that their children have not been selected for Hogwarts. The book and quill's decision is final, and no child has ever been admitted whose name has not first been inscribed on the book's yellowing pages. At the precise moment that a child first exhibits signs of magic, the quill, which is believed to have been taken from an augury, floats up out of its inkpot and attempts to inscribe the name of that child upon the pages of the book. Augury feathers are known to repel ink, and the inkpot is empty. Nobody has ever managed to analyze precisely what the silvery fluid flowing from the enchanted quill is. Those few who have observed the process, several headmasters and headmistresses have enjoyed spending quiet hours in the book and quill's tower, hoping to catch them in action, agree that the quill might be judged more lenient than the book. A mere whiff of magic suffices for the quill. The book, however, will often snap shut, refusing to be written upon until it receives sufficiently dramatic evidence of magical ability. Thus, the very moment that Neville Longbottom was born, the quill attempted to write his name and was refused by the book, which snapped shut. Even the midwife who attended Alice Longbottom had failed to notice that Neville managed to shift his blankets more snugly over himself moments after birth, assuming that his father had tucked the baby in more securely. Neville's family persistently missed faint signs of magic in him, and not until he was 8 years old did either his disappointed great-aunts and uncles or the old stickler of a book accept that he was truly a wizard, when he survived a fall that should have killed him. In fact, the book's sternness has a purpose. Its track record in keeping squibs out of Hogwarts is perfect. Non-magic children born to witches and wizards occasionally have some small, residual aura of magic about them due to their parents. But once their parents' magic has worn off them, it becomes clear that they will never have the ability to perform spells. The quill's sensitivity, coupled with the book's implacability, has never yet made a mistake.
Chapter 5. The Triwizard Schools. For almost every student who does meet the approval of both quill and book, it's off to Hogwarts as soon as they're of age. Some parents might send their child to an international school or educate them at home instead, but this is very rare. As Professor Lupin tells Harry, Ron and Hermione, nearly every witch and wizard in Britain has been educated at Hogwarts. So Hoggy Warty Hogwarts, as the school song goes, is hugely significant. Like the other European schools that compete in the Triwizard Tournament, Beauxbatons and Durmstrang, its influence extends beyond the school gates. We'll learn much more about Hogwarts later on, but given its prestigious reputation, it is an obvious choice to host the Triwizard Tournament. Certain members of the Beauxbatons and Durmstrang delegations may think their methods and food options superior, but there's no denying Hogwarts' remote Scottish Highland setting is a fine place to hold a tournament that requires the presence of dragons, merpeople, and a sphinx. Still, when your students are taking part in a dangerous tournament that demands exceptional skill, a certain healthy rivalry is to be expected. Every one of the Triwizard competing schools certainly has that. Wizarding schools. Rivalrous they may be, but there's no denying that Hogwarts, Beauxbatons, and Durmstrang are all strong schools. From magical practice to sporting prowess, the education they provide is incredibly important. But where do these European powerhouses sit within the wider world of wizarding education?
The number of countries that have their own magical school is minuscule compared to those that do not. This is because the wizarding populations of most countries choose the option of homeschooling. Occasionally, too, the magical community in a given country is tiny or far-flung, and correspondence courses have been found a more cost-effective means of educating the young. There are 11 long-established and prestigious wizarding schools worldwide, all of which are registered with the International Confederation of Wizards. Smaller and less well-regulated institutions have come and gone, are difficult to keep track of, and are rarely registered with the appropriate ministry, in which case I cannot vouch for the standard of education they might offer. Anyone wishing to know whether there is an approved magical school in their region should address an OWL inquiry to the International Confederation of Wizards Educational Office. The precise location of each of the following schools is a closely guarded secret. The schools fear not only Muggle persecution, for it is a sad fact that at various times in their long histories, all of these institutions have been buffeted by the effects of wizard wars and of hostile attention from both the foreign and domestic magical communities. It is not only in Britain that the education of magical youth has been subject to ministry interference or pressure. As a general rule, magical schools tend to be situated in landlocked, mountainous areas, although there are notable exceptions, as will be seen, as such regions are difficult for Muggles to access and easier to defend from dark wizards.
Beauxbatons Academy of Magic. It is Hermione who first tells Harry and Ron about Beauxbatons. She reads about it in an appraisal of magical education in Europe, naturally. This is at the Quidditch World Cup, weeks before the Triwizard Tournament brings Beauxbatons students, including Fleur Delacour, Part Vila, Triwizard champion, later Ron's sister-in-law, to Hogwarts aboard a giant winged horse-drawn carriage. So if the Beauxbatons delegation travels in such inimitable style, what are they like on home turf?
Beauxbatons. Thought to be situated somewhere in the Pyrenees, visitors speak of the breathtaking beauty of a chateau surrounded by formal gardens and lawns created out of the mountainous landscape by magic. Beauxbatons Academy has a preponderance of French students, though Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, Luxembourgians and Belgians also attend in large numbers. Both Beauxbatons and Durmstrang have a larger student ship than Hogwarts. It is said that the stunning castle and grounds of this prestigious school were part funded by alchemist gold, for Nicholas and Perenel Flamel met at Beauxbatons in their youth, and a magnificent fountain in the middle of the school's park, believed to have healing and beautifying properties, is named for them. Beauxbatons has always enjoyed a cordial relationship with Hogwarts, though there has been a healthy rivalry in international competitions, such as the Triwizard Tournament, in which Beauxbatons has 62 wins to Hogwarts 63. Apart from the Flamels, famous ex-students of Beauxbatons include Vincent, Duc de Trèfle-Pic, who escaped the terror by casting a concealment charm on his neck and pretending that his head had already been cut off. Luc Millefeuille, the infamous pastry maker and Muggle poisoner, and Fleur Delacour, who fought in the world-famous Battle of Hogwarts and was awarded medals of bravery from both the French and British Ministries of Magic. Headmistress Olympe Maxime is, in spite of her protestations to the contrary, half giantess. Brilliant, elegant, and undeniably awe-inspiring.
Durmstrang Institute. Based on Durmstrang's entry in an appraisal of magical education in Europe, Hermione's view of this other great European school is not positive. It's got a horrible reputation, she tells Ron and Harry. It puts a lot of emphasis on the dark arts. In fact, according to Draco Malfoy, his father considered sending him to Durmstrang for precisely that reason. But is Durmstrang deserving of such notoriety? How much does it focus on the dark arts, really?
Durmstrang. Durmstrang once had the darkest reputation of all 11 wizarding schools, though this was never entirely merited. It is true that Durmstrang, which has turned out many truly great witches and wizards, has twice in its history fallen under the stewardship of wizards of dubious allegiance or nefarious intent, and that it has one infamous ex-pupil. The first of these unhappy men, Harfang Munter, took over the school shortly after the mysterious death of its founder, the great Bulgarian witch Nerida Valchanova. Munter established Durmstrang's reputation for dueling and all forms of martial magic, which remain an impressive part of its curriculum today. The second dark period in Durmstrang's history came with the headmastership of Igor Karkaroff, an ex-Death Eater who fled his post upon the return from exile of Lord Voldemort, fearing the latter's retribution. Karkaroff was an unprincipled and egotistical man who encouraged a culture of fear and intimidation among the students, and many parents withdrew their children from Durmstrang while he was in charge. The ex-pupil who has done more than any other to cause damage to Durmstrang's reputation is Gellert Grindelwald, one of the most dangerous wizards of the 20th century. However, in recent years, Durmstrang has undergone something of a renaissance and has produced such international luminaries as international Quidditch star Victor Krum. Although believed to be situated in the far north of Europe, Durmstrang is one of the most secretive of all schools about its whereabouts, so nobody can be quite certain. Visitors, who must comply with memory charms to erase their knowledge of how they got there, speak of vast, sprawling grounds with many stunning views, not least of the great, dark, spectral ship that is moored on a mountain lake behind the school, from which students dive in summertime.
Wizarding schools outside Europe include Castelo Bruxo in Brazil, Ilvermorny in the United States, Ouagadou in Uganda, and Mahotokoro in Japan, which, when you also consider all the young witches and wizards studying magic at home or via correspondence courses, is a lot of learning. Given this vastness of scope, it's impossible to know everything about every corner of the wizarding world. But perhaps there are some plot lines where a little illumination is possible. Chapter 6. Alternate Histories. When you have an entire world of witchcraft and wizardry at your fingertips, it's easy to get distracted. Casting spells, brewing potions, encountering magical creatures. These aren't just Hogwarts subjects. They are uniquely fascinating topics. Hermione's third year timetable might be a bit full on and require access to a time turner, but it's really no wonder she wants to study everything she can. And this is before we get into the backstories of all other Wizarding World characters. From the people Harry meets on his first trip to Diagon Alley, to the other students who take part in his Hogwarts sorting ceremony, there are many magical folk in Harry's life about which we know comparatively little. Alas, without access to Hermione's time turner, there will never be time enough to explore every nook and cranny of the wizarding world, even the bits that aren't unplottable. We do, however, have the next best thing, excerpts from J.K. Rowling's notebooks. So in this chapter, we're going to explore a few of the early character iterations and so-called ghost plots that never made it into the published Harry Potter books. The Original 40. The first student in Harry's school year to be sorted is Hannah Abbott, a Hufflepuff who pops up at various other points during Harry's time at Hogwarts. Amongst other things, Hannah frets about exams and becomes a prefect alongside Ron and Hermione. Later, she is an oft-mentioned member of Dumbledore's army, the secret defense against the dark arts group created by Hermione during Professor Umbridge's tenure at Hogwarts. Being an abbot, Hannah appears first on the alphabetical list of students reproduced here, as J.K. Rowling recalls the original 40 students she created to populate Harry's school year. And Hannah's is not the only name you may recognise. But between Lavender Brown and Ronald Weasley, there are other less familiar names, as well as some that sound just a little bit different. Let's go back to the beginning, shall we?
Author's note. Two of my most prized possessions are a pair of small notebooks which contain my very first scribblings about Harry Potter. Much of what is written in them was never used in the series, although it is startling to come across the odd line of dialogue that subsequently made it verbatim to publication. In one of the books is a list of 40 names of students in Harry's year, including Harry, Ron, and Hermione, all allocated houses with small symbols beside each name, depicting each boy or girl's parentage. While I imagine that there would be considerably more than 40 students in each year at Hogwarts, I thought that it would be useful to know a proportion of Harry's classmates and to have names at my fingertips when action was taking place around the school. As the stories evolved, I changed the parentage of some of the original 40. While some never appeared in the books at all, I always knew that they were there. Some had surgery to their names after their first creation. A few emerged from the background to have their own secondary stories. Ernie Macmillan, Hannah Abbott, Justin Finch Fletchley. And one, Neville Longbottom, developed into a very important character. It is very strange to look at the list in this tiny notebook now, slightly water-stained by some forgotten mishap and covered in light pencil scribblings, undoubtedly the work of my then-infant daughter, Jessica. And to think that while I was writing these names and refining them and sorting them into houses, I had no clue where they were going to go or where they were going to take me. Here, then, are the original 40. Abbott, Hannah. Bones, Susan. Boot, Trevor. Brocklehurst, Mandy. Brown, Lavender. Bulstrode, Millicent. Corner, Michael. Cornfoot, Stephen. Crab, Vincent. Davis, Tracy. Entwistle, Kevin. Finch Fletchley, Justin. Finnegan, Seamus. Goldstein, Anthony. Goyle, Gregory. Granger, Hermione. Inserted in pencil, see crossed out entry below. Greengrass, Queenie. Hopkins, Wayne. Jones, Megan. Lee, Sue. Longbottom, Neville. Inserted in ink, see crossed out entry below. McDougall, Isabel. Original name, Katrina, crossed out. Macmillan, Ernest. Malfoy, Draco. Inserted in ink, see crossed out entry below. Malone, Roger. Moon, Lily. First intimation of Luna Lovegood. This name was never used, but gave me an idea for a fey, dreamy girl. She was named before I decided on Harry's mother's name. Not Theodore. Parkinson, Pansy. Patel, Madhari. Patel, Matty. Perks, Celianne. Potter, Harry. Puckle, Hermione. Crossed out, name changed, and reinserted above. Puff, Neville. Crossed out, name changed, and reinserted above. Quirrell. Crossed out, subsequently used for teacher. Rivers, Oliver. Roper, Sophie. Sidebottom, Neville, crossed out. Smith, Sally. Georgina, crossed out. Spungen, changed to Spinks, Draco, all crossed out, reinserted above. Thomas, Gary. Turpin, Lisa. Weasley, Ronald. Zabini, Blaze.
Ghost plots. We have already seen that magic has its own limits. Well, so too does storytelling. And one of storytelling's limits is time. It is just not feasible to take a deep dive into every topic, no matter how fascinating. This means there are always going to be unexplored storylines hovering out of sight. Or, to put it in J.K. Rowling's own words, there will always be ghost plots. This personal expression, she explains, has nothing to do with Tales of the Dead. Instead, it refers to those unused plots which previously existed only in her notes.
Author's note. Over the 17 years that I planned and wrote the 7 Harry Potter books, not to mention Quidditch Through the Ages, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and the tales of Beedle the Bard, I generated a mass of information about the magical world that never appeared in the books. I liked knowing these things, which was fortunate given that I couldn't stop my imagination spewing it all out. And often, when I needed a throwaway detail, I had it ready because of the background I had developed. I also found myself developing storylines for secondary or even tertiary characters that were superfluous to requirements. More of a wrench were the plots I worked out for some much more important characters that had to be sacrificed for the bigger story. All of these I inwardly termed ghost plots, my private expression for all the untold stories that sometimes seemed quite as real to me as the final cut. I have occasionally been in conversation with a reader and made mention of part of a ghost plot. Looks of consternation cross their faces as, for a split second, they ask themselves whether they have accidentally skipped 20 pages somewhere. I apologize to anyone I might have accidentally wrong-footed in this way. The problem is, literally, all in my head.
Florian Fortescue. As a former headmaster of Hogwarts, Dexter Fortescue's portrait appears on the wall of the headmaster's study. He is described as corpulent and red-nosed, and he seems a little pompous. Nevertheless, when Harry enters the headmaster's study after defeating Voldemort at the Battle of Hogwarts, Dexter can be seen waving his ear trumpet in enthusiastic delight. The following ghost plot reveals a connection between blustering Dexter and Diagon Alley's Florian Fortescue, supplier of free ice creams to Harry when he's living alone in the Leaky Cauldron in Prisoner of Azkaban. But if this little snippet is anything to go by, there is a lot more to Florian than his Choco Nut Sundaes.
Florian Fortescue, owner of an ice cream parlour in Diagon Alley, is the subject of a ghost plot, a narrative that never made it into the final books. Harry meets him in Prisoner of Azkaban, where he finds out that Florian knows a lot about medieval wizards. Later, Harry discovers that an ex-headmaster of Hogwarts was called Dexter Fortescue.
Author's note. Florian is a descendant of Dexter, and I originally planned Florian to be the conduit for clues that I needed to give Harry during his quest for the Hallows, which is why I established an acquaintance fairly early on. At this stage, I imagine the historically minded Florian might have a smattering of information on matters as diverse as the Elder Wand and the Diadem of Ravenclaw, the information having been passed down in the Fortescue family from their august ancestor. As I worked my way nearer to the point where such information would become necessary, I caused Florian to be kidnapped, intending him to be found or rescued by Harry and his friends. The problem was that when I came to write the key parts of Deathly Hallows, I decided that Phineas Nigellus Black was a much more satisfactory means of conveying clues. Florian's information on the diadem also felt redundant, as I could give the reader everything he or she needed by interviewing the Grey Lady. All in all, I seem to have had him kidnapped and killed for no reason. He is not the first wizard whom Voldemort murdered because he knew too much or too little. But he is the only one I feel guilty about, because it was all my fault.
Ghost plots like poor Florian's are tantalising, because they shine a pinprick of light down into the engine of Harry's story. What other characters may have proved important? Which other storylines might have been explored? The possibilities seem endless, as does the potential for distraction. Of course, this doesn't mean that these ghost plots and hitherto less recognised characters won't now haunt subsequent rereads of the Harry Potter books. But there they must stay, floating on the periphery. Chapter 7. Dark Creatures. Outside the cozy environs of Hogwarts, and too often also inside it, let's be honest, the wizarding world is home to a number of dark creatures. While many of these sinister beings might be more at home watching from dark corners and hovering in hidden spaces, when they do come in from the shadows, they are unpredictable at best and dangerous at worst. So how best to prepare to face such a foe? Why, pay attention during Defense Against the Dark Arts, of course. But don't worry, there are no boring textbooks in this lesson. Harry's classmates may have battled to concentrate on chapter after dull chapter of Professor Umbridge's favourite textbook, Defensive Magical Theory, but the creatures in the coming paragraphs are anything but boring. No danger of drifting off into daydreams here. Time then to sharpen those quills and focus that mind. After all, to quote another of Harry's Defense Against the Dark Arts professors, Mad-Eye Moody, one can only hope to defeat these creatures of darkness if one practices constant vigilance. Boggart. If Professor Moody's approach to dark creatures and dark magic is vigilance hovering perilously close to paranoia, Professor Lupin's is a tad more thoughtful and much more balanced. As one of Hogwarts' best-loved Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers, Lupin encourages his students to understand the creatures they are studying, but he also knows when to introduce practical application. His first lesson with Harry's class is a case in point. Discovering there is a boggart living in the staff room wardrobe, Lupin marches his third year straight in to confront it, although many have never seen a boggart before. Before opening up the wardrobe, though, Lupin does of course offer his class a little context about what they are about to face. As he says, "The first question we must ask ourselves is, what is a boggart?"
A boggart is a shape-shifting creature that will assume the form of whatever most frightens the person who encounters it. Nobody knows what a boggart looks like if nobody is there to see it, although it continues to exist, usually giving evidence of its presence by rattling, shaking, or scratching the object in which it is hiding. Boggarts particularly like confined spaces, but may also be found lurking in woods and around shadowy corners. The more generally fearful a person is, the more susceptible they will be to boggarts. Muggles, too, feel their presence and may even glimpse them, although they seem less capable of seeing them plainly and are usually easily convinced that the boggart was a figment of their imagination. Like a poltergeist, a boggart is not and never has been truly alive. It is one of these strange non-beings that populates the magical world for which there is no equivalent in the Muggle realm. Boggarts can be made to disappear, but more boggarts will inevitably arise to take their place. Like poltergeists and the more sinister dementors, they seem to be generated and sustained by human emotions. The spell that defeats a boggart can be tricky because it involves making the creature into a figure of fun so that fear can be dispelled in amusement. If the caster is able to laugh aloud at the boggart, it will disappear at once. The incantation is ridiculous, and the intention is to force the boggart to assume a less threatening and hopefully comical form. Famous boggarts include the Old Boggle of Canterbury, believed by local muggles to be a mad, cannibalistic hermit that lived in a cave. In reality, a particularly small boggart that had learned how to make the most of echoes. The bludgeoning boggart of Old London Town, a boggart that had taken on the form of a murderous thug that prowled the back streets of 19th century London, but which could be reduced to a hamster with one simple incantation. And the screaming bogey of Strathtully, a Scottish boggart that had fed on the fears of local muggles to the point that it had become an elephantine black shadow with glowing white eyes, but which Lyle Lupin of the Ministry of Magic eventually trapped in a matchbox.
Inferi. Lupin is the first Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher to teach Harry's class about boggarts, but it is Professor Snape who explains what an Inferius is. Although explains is perhaps too polite a description for Snape's teaching style.
The Inferius is a corpse that has been reanimated by a dark wizard spell.